Well, brethren, when they asked if we'd like to do a study, well, I love to study scriptures. And so this is something we've been studying in San Diego, so that's what we chose. We've been going through Leviticus. We went through Exodus and now into Leviticus. And we're going to study and focus on some chapters that we collectively as Bible students often don't study too much. Now, we do study Leviticus a lot. But, you know, most of the studies that we do in Leviticus from Tabernacle Shadows are in three chapters, chapter 8, chapter 9, and then the famous one, chapter 16, Day of Atonement. Now, I think that it's largely the understanding of chapter 16 and the Day of Atonement that really was the trigger for Brother Russell to put together Tabernacle Shadows. That's just my opinion. Because he was struggling with some issues and some interpretations about the Day of Atonement. And imagine when you're early in the harvest and you're thinking about these things and you realize that the whole key to the divine plan is that there's not one, but two separate and distinct ages of redemption. And then you see in Leviticus 16 that on the Day of Atonement, first you atone for the priests, and then, after that, you made an atonement for all the rest of the people. Well, what a natural way to see that there are first the development of the priest class, the church, and then the whole world of mankind. So I think that was just a real trigger that stimulated his thinking here. So in Leviticus, in Tabernacle Shadows, Brother Russell starts off, you know, as far as those three chapters are concerned, with chapter 8, because that comes first. That's the consecration of the priesthood. And it takes 7 days to finish this work. And I think it's a picture of the consecration of the church, of you, and I hope myself, for the divine service beyond the veil. It takes 7 days, that's seven stages of the church, to finish this process. And there's a lot of detail in Tabernacle Shadows on that. We're not going to look at that too much today. That's what you've all been studying for a long time. And then in Tabernacle Shadows, you jump right to Leviticus 16. And then you go through the Day of Atonement sacrifices. And then you back up to the ninth chapter. And he says, well, that's kind of another view of the atonement. And we'll look at that in just a moment. But the in-between chapters, chapter 10 through 15, we just kind of skip over. So we've been looking at that in a lot of detail recently. Now, in chapter 15, there's some very delicate things, and we're not going to study that publicly. You can read it at your leisure. I'm sure there's spiritual lessons there. But the other chapters, 10 through 14, we're going to look at. And there's basically four parts to that. We'll show that in just a moment. But when you get to Leviticus and you want to jump to chapter 8, to start, what about the first seven chapters? What is in those chapters? So when we've been studying in San Diego, we've been trying to really grasp the whole flow of the book. And to do that, you really have to start back a little bit in chapter 40 of Exodus. Now, I didn't know this for a long time. This is all prelude, by the way. This really is supposed to be a study. It'll be a directed study. But this is prelude. But in Exodus, the 40th chapter, you have the time come when from chapter 19, they arrived at Mount Sinai. And then they begin this interplay with God, and he describes all things to do. Finally, you got all the preparations for the tabernacle ready. And in chapter 40, God says to Moses, wait until the time when I tell you, and it's going to be the first day of the first month of the next year. You wait till New Year's Day, and then you can put together the tabernacle. So that's Exodus chapter 40. And then he explains what you're going to do. You're going to set up the holy and put up the pillars, and you set up the court and put all the furnishings in, and then you're going to consecrate all the priests. You'll find all those directions in chapter 40 of Exodus. And then in chapter 40 of Exodus, it also says, about halfway through the chapter, the day came. Here's the second year in wilderness, the first day, the first month. So now go ahead and put it all together. So it says Moses, through his helpers, put everything together. And they had the tabernacle all constructed. And there's the tabernacle all together. And suddenly, God intervened. The very last verses of Exodus, when they built the tabernacle, they erected it, God intervenes and he speaks out of the tabernacle itself and he stops the whole operation. Well, we haven't even got to the consecration of the priesthood. He said that's what you're supposed to do, but you can't do that. God's interrupting this process and he's speaking. And what God says, goes on for seven chapters, but it's a different book in our Bible. It's no longer Exodus. You turn the page to Leviticus. But it's the same narrative. And what you have for seven chapters in Leviticus is all the directions for what to do when you have an animal sacrifice. And there's basically three kinds of sacrifices. You've got burnt offerings, that's fundamental. We'll talk about that in a few moments. And then you've got peace offerings, and you've got sin offerings. Now, there's shades of these kind of things, and there's other things. Those are the three fundamental offerings. Well, how do you do it? That's what Leviticus chapters 1 through 7 are all about. Here's how you do a burnt offering. It's got to be a male. It can be from the herd or the flock, but it better be spotless. And this is, you're going to burn the whole thing. And amazingly, this is the only offering that it says it's going to go right on the wood. Right on the wood. And I think that means the wood of the cross, by the way. So the next chapter, you go into the meal offering that you add to a burnt offering. And then the next chapter goes into a peace offering, which represent our consecrations and devotions. And that goes, it says, right on top of the burnt offering, which is right on top of the wood. That's meaningful. That means if we want to give a consecration or a devotion to God, it can only be based on that burnt offering, that complete whole offering, which is right on the wood, right on the wood of the ransom. So that's, and then you go on to a sin offering, and then you go on to a nuance of the sin offering called a trespass offering. And you go through the whole thing again with rules about how the priests are going to interplay on these points. And finally, when you get to the seventh chapter, everything's, all the directions are given. And now God says, okay, where were we now? Let's pick up the thread. Oh, yes, we have to consecrate the priesthood. So chapter 8 is the very same day that the tabernacle was built. Chapter 8 of Leviticus begins consecrating the priesthood. And that takes 7 days, and then you got to get the people devoted and atoned for. That's chapter 9. And then he gives the directions for chapter 16. Now, by the way, chapter 16 is the one that we all know most about, the Day of Atonement. That's where we focus a lot of time and attention. You know that in Leviticus, you actually never get to that point? You never do. Remember, they set up the tabernacle the first day of the first month of the brand new year. And if you look at the book of Numbers, you're to the next month after that in the same year. You never get to the Day of Atonement. If you look at Leviticus 16, it says, when you do get to the Day of Atonement in the autumn of the year, this is what you're going to do. You're going to do this and that, and everything is future tense. That's not the way it is in Leviticus 8. Everything is present tense. Moses did this, he did that. Leviticus 9, he did this, he did that. Leviticus 16, that's all directions about the time when you finally get there. You never get there in Leviticus. It's all future. You get through Leviticus, you're still in the same month. You're just ready to get to the next month. Okay, so that's a lot of introduction, I know. Now, here's a little picture of the tabernacle here. And I just want to add one point that was so different when we went through the study of the tabernacle. It's kind of unrelated in a sense. But it's such a vibrant point, and we never saw this in San Diego until we really looked carefully at some of the description. And that is, when you go into the holy, and that's where we are here. This room even kind of looks like a holy. What a nice place for a convention. Oh, so you go into the holy and you look to the right. What do you see on the right? What is there? Table of showbread. Okay, now let me ask you the obvious question. What is on the table of showbread? What's there? Donna? Showbread. Okay, you've got it. And there were two stacks, six and six. And I can't help but think that that's, what is six and six, Donna? 12? How many tribes of Israel were there? 12. So this is like a picture of the spiritual nourishment for the 12 tribes of Israel. But now let's take that to the next step. Your spiritual Israel, this is all a spiritual picture. So this would represent the bread of life, as it were, for spiritual Israel. Okay, now that's, what did Jesus say about him with relationship to the bread? What did he say, John, the sixth chapter? I am the bread that came down from heaven. That's right. I am the bread of life. The bread that I will give is my flesh that I will give for the life of the world. Okay, so that's really important bread there. Now, I was surprised when you go through Leviticus, because actually, a little bit later, it tells you how big those loaves are. Well, those are pretty big. Now, it's unleavened, but they're pretty big. They're not just, you know, a slice of bread. They're really pretty big. You remember David came with a large band of people, and he was very famished in the book of Samuel. And he says to the priest, "You got anything to eat?" He says, "You remember that episode?"
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, Rita. Yeah. What was that episode? What happened there? He asked the priest, "You got anything to eat?" And what did the priest say? "We got some old show bread. Okay, we're just ready to change it out." And he says, "You know, but you know, this is supposed to be sacred." He says, "Well, you know, our men have been kept clean for a while, kept pure for a while." He says, okay, you can take that. And Jesus used that, by the way, as an example later on. He says, you know, only the priests are supposed to eat this stuff, right? But, you know, in case of necessity, you know, to paraphrase something Jesus said, the law was made for man, not man for the law. Now, he actually said that about the Sabbath. You know, the Sabbath was made for man, not as some kind of a burdensome stone to put up on your ankles. That's why you can rescue an animal in need on the Sabbath. And don't worry about, you know, a few grains of wheat that were taken to eat, you know. Don't worry about that kind of problem, he says. Okay, now the point I want to get to about this table of showbread is, and I'll ask this question, other than showbread on that table, what else is on that table? Other than showbread, what else is there? Cups, pans, utensils, all of that is right. What else is there? What do you need? What kind of utensils do you need? You need a fork and a knife to eat the bread? I mean, what else is there? Gene, there's wine on that table? You mean the table of showbread was a table of bread and wine? Okay. Did you know that? I didn't know that going back a little while, but I think the sister Jean is right. Now, I knew she'd know the answer because we had some fellowship yesterday, and Brother David and Jean, I asked them what is on that table. I said, well, bread and wine. You know that? I was shocked. Because it is really, really veiled in the King James. Now, let's look at a scripture on this point. Oh, we're going to get to Leviticus still, but this is Exodus 37:16. Now, I'd like somebody to have the King James Version to read that for us, Exodus 37:16. Just raise your hand if you've got that and can read it for us. We do read here, right? We do. Okay, read it.
37:16.
Yes, please.
And he made the vessels which were upon the table, his dishes and his spoons and his bowls and his covers to cover withal of pure gold.
Nothing about a pitcher there, nothing about wine there, nothing about, but it's there. Now, does anybody have the NIV? What we have back here, Brother James, in back of you, Keith?
Sorry.
Brother James, could you read that same verse, Brother James? Read that same verse from the NIV, and notice how very, very different this is.
And they made from pure gold the articles for the table, its plates, dishes, bowls, and its pitchers for pouring out the drink offering.
Pitchers for pouring out the drink offering. What is it? A drink offering is wine that you pour out on a sacrifice. On this table, there's a pitcher for pouring out a drink offering. Now, may I say there's four items here, and I'm going to give you the words that I think, gathering from other translations, are the essential words. On this table, there are going to be plates. That's number one. Now, if you have people over for dinner at your house, and you're going to serve them bread, do you take the bread and put it right on the table? You might, you know, but you probably wouldn't. You probably put it on a plate. So the first ingredient here is there are plates that the bread is going to go on. And then it says there are dishes. Now I'm using a translation, composite translation here. There are dishes. Well, the plate is what the bread goes on. The dishes go on top of the bread. And in those dishes, there's something very fragrant on the top of this. What do you think that is?
Incense,
that's right. Now, what is it? What kind of incense does it call it? Do you remember?
Frank
incense. Do you know what that word means as opposed to regular incense? I didn't. I had to look it up. Check it out. But I think it relates to this word that even comes from French, franc. A franc is a currency, the old currency, you know, before the euro. It's something precious and something unique, something good. And I think this is telling us this is not just normal incense, this is the best kind of incense. This is frank incense. That's the derivation of the point. So there's dishes for that, and then there's cups, and then there's pitchers. And the pitchers are going to contain the wine for the drink offering. But another text in Exodus says, specifically on the golden altar here, you never use wine of a drink offering on the golden altar. You never do that. So there's not enough wine in those pitchers to use out here in the court because that requires a lot of wine. So I propose that the wine that's on that table, we could call show wine. It's there for display, just like the bread is. The bread is there not to eat. Okay, they did eat it when they changed it out. It was getting stale. They just disposed of it. But this is to display the emblems. There's bread and wine. Now, if you enter the holy, like we're in the holy here, and you look to your right and you see a table with bread and wine, Amelia, who are you going to think of when you think bread and wine is on that table? Jesus, obviously. And it was just never so clear to me before. Now that you see the bread and the wine, the two emblems, you turn to your right and there you see Jesus. You turn to your left and there you see the seven-branch candlestick. Who is that? Seven branches of one institution. Who does that represent? That's the church in development. And then both of them make their offerings, Jesus and the church, at the golden altar, which wafts in, as it were, our prayers to the Most Holy. Now, the whole thing just makes more sense to me. It's just more complete. Okay, now we're using a lot of time here, so we're going to go on. And we're going to skip now to chapter 10. Now, I'm going to suggest for you that the difference between chapter 9, which is an immediate atonement, now that you got the priesthood involved, you better get the people atoned for, and chapter 16, when you had the formal yearly day of atonement, you always had to do, I'm just going to suggest to you that the difference between these is that the first one focuses on the atonement for the church, and the second one focuses on the atonement for the people, for the world. Now, I know that in the Day of Atonement, first you do the priests, and then you do the... But that's only a stepping stone to get to the world of mankind. And I think the focus in Leviticus 9 is the devotion, is the atonement for the church in the gospel age. Spring is always gospel age. Autumn is always millennial age, kingdom time. There's one notable difference in Leviticus 9 and Leviticus 16. In both chapters, you have burnt offerings and sin offerings. In my opinion, that's the ransom and the sin offering. But in Leviticus 9, you have a kind of offering that does not appear in Leviticus 16. Do you know what that is? It's not formally part of the study tonight, but do you know what that is that you have? What kind of offering do you have in Leviticus 9 that is missing in Leviticus 16? Okay, that is correct, and that's not what I had in mind. But it is correct. But I'm talking about another kind of offering. We have three fundamental offerings. One of them is missing in Leviticus 16, but it is in Leviticus 9. Say again? Peace offering. Who said that? Who is that? Was it? That's it. The peace offering. A peace offering represents your devotion and your consecration. You know, in the consecration of the priesthood, we always talk about a ram of consecration. That was a peace offering. That's the kind of offering that was. A peace offering is not something that makes peace for you. That was my early, you know, growing in the truth misunderstanding. A peace offering is something that you give because you have peace. And now you can make an offering of devotion or consecration. That's why the ram of consecration pictures the consecration of the church. And it's a peace offering because we have peace. And you know, I think Paul picked up on that. If you turn, somebody please turn to Romans, the 5th chapter. We're going to read the verse just before that, the end of chapter 4, and then the first verse of chapter 5. And notice how he makes this connection about peace. Brian, it looks like you're on your way there. Are you? Is that Romans 5:1, but the verse just before that, and then Romans 5:1.
So Romans 4:25, who was delivered up for our trespasses and raised for our justification,
Okay, there's our justification. Go ahead.
And 5:1. Therefore, since we have been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ.
And one more.
Through him we have also obtained access by faith into this grace in which we stand, and we rejoice in the hope of the glory of God.
Okay. So first thing is we have justification, and that gives us peace. And now we have access, now that we have peace, into this grace in which we stand and have hope of the high calling of God. There's the peace offering that we give, our consecration, based on the peace that we have. We can now make our consecration and be accepted. Leviticus 9 has a peace offering. Leviticus 16, there are no peace offerings. I just suggest that this is telling us again, Leviticus 9 is focusing on the church who does consecrate unto death. But Leviticus 16, the focus is on the world of mankind. And they don't consecrate the same way. They will be devoted. It wouldn't be bad to have them make peace offerings. But to contrast with the church, we're consecrated unto death. And I think that's why it's included in one place, not the other. Okay, if that's true, that means that from Leviticus chapter 9 to Leviticus chapter 16, we're focusing on the gospel age and then later on the millennial age. And the chapters between those, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and even 15, but we won't get there, I think are taking us things that pertain to both the church and the world, and maybe starting off mostly with the church, and then getting mostly with the world the farther you go through this series. Now, this is what you find in Leviticus chapters 10, 11, 12, and then 13, 14 is one unit, one subject. In chapter 10, Nadab and Abihu are smitten down because they carried some wrong kind of incense before the Lord. Now, do you have any opinion as to what Nadab and Abihu might represent? These two priests that were cut down and therefore not allowed to really function as part of the operating priesthood. Two of Aaron's sons are cut down. Any comment you have on this? How many sons did he have? How many were living that after these two died? And what does it mean that these two were cut off? Any comment on that? I realize all of us are spontaneous here. We all know that, so you're comfortable to speak. Yes, who is speaking?
Babylon,
okay. So in other words, those that could have been part of the priesthood are going to be cut off from it. Okay, why two? What two classes might have been part of the royal priesthood but won't end up there? Okay, that's a good answer too. Was Israel ever consecrated as part of the priesthood? They never made it that far. So that's an excellent answer. And I actually hadn't thought of that answer, but I think because these are only those that have been once at least attempted to be consecrated to the priesthood, then didn't make it. Sister Donna, that's pretty good too. But the scribes and Pharisees never really entered into the whole act of consecration. So those are all good answers, all good groups that could have had. You answered my question. That is, groups that could have had but didn't make it. Okay, so let me refine my question. Those that were actually in the running for the high calling, they're great company, great, and those that lose their spiritual life altogether. Okay, I think so. I think those are the two. Now, Brother Russell does actually suggest that in Tabernacle Shadows, and those are the two classes he puts together. It sounds logical to me. But how many sons did Aaron actually have? Four. Who were the other two? We know Nadab and Abihu. Who were the other two? Ithamar and Eleazar. That's right. And if you go through the history of Israel, you'll find that after Aaron's day, Eleazar took over the priesthood. In fact, when Aaron was going to die, they took him up to the mountain, you know, and said, okay, put all your clothing of the high priest onto Eleazar, and he's going to be the new priest. But somehow, it all shifted. And somebody later who was from Ithamar became the high priest. Do you know who that might have been? You remember one of the priests that was from Ithamar? Now, this won't be on the tip of your tongue. You have to really dig deep for this and find out some. Say again? Phineas. Phineas, one of the Phineases. One of the Phineases was a son of Eli, if I'm not mistaken. Eli is the priest that became from Ithamar. And we don't really quite understand how it transacted. If you do a little research in this commentaries and so forth, say we don't really know how this happened. But the high priesthood went from Eliezer to Ithamar. So you've got both of these two sons that are represented in the high priesthood as time goes by. So why do you have, if two represent that are cut off, represent the church, the great company and those that lose their spiritual life, what about the two that are remaining? Why two, Eliezer and Ithamar, to represent the church that will be part of the priesthood? Ruth? And then after that, where'd they go? To the Gentiles. And I have a hunch that that's the point. Now, this is interpretive. You know, a lot of things are. But I have a hunch that it's the Jews and the Gentiles that are composite part of the church. Now, you know, Paul makes a great point of this. Is it the book of Ephesians where he says the middle wall of partition has been broken down and he hath made of two parts one new body in Christ? And I think maybe the Jews and the Gentiles are the issue here. You're not the chairman, I hope. Okay. All right. Fear sweeps over me. Okay. So Nadab and Abihu are cut off. Now, in the same lesson, in the same chapter, in chapter 10, there's a warning against a certain conduct by the priest. Make sure you never do this. What is the warning against? Never drink wine while you're officiating. What does that imply about Nadab and Abihu? Maybe they weren't quite in their senses. And that's why they did this. And they'd offered something they weren't supposed to do. So here's the warning. Never drink wine when you're on duty here. Yes. Excellent. And is there anybody later in prophecy, like in Revelation, that really has a problem with wine? Babylon, that's right. Exactly. They have a great Babylon. That's their name on her forehead. The nations are drunk with the wine of her fornication, and she's drunk with the blood of the saints. And we just don't want to be involved with the wine, the intoxicating wine of the spirit of this world or Babylon. We want to set that aside. If you're going to be part of the priesthood, you've got to have a clear mind, think spiritual thoughts, and think clearly about what our obligations to God are. Okay. Now, Nadab and Abihu were struck dead. Who carried them away? All these quick impromptu questions you probably haven't thought about, you know. Who carried them away? Yeah, Ruth? Say again? Their father Aaron?
Yeah, didn't he?
Okay, that's close, but it's a relative of Aaron. But not Aaron himself. Mm-hmm. And there's a problem with Aaron doing it. Aaron's a high priest, and he's got a function. And if you're associated with a dead body, it's going to contaminate you. Even for your own sons, the high priest has a problem with this way. So who did carry them out? Yes, Brother James. Say that one more time for the record.
Elizaphan?
These other two people.
And his uncle, Uziel.
Uziel. So it's in-laws that were brought up. They're Levites, but they're in-laws.
Yeah.
They're not part of the priesthood.
No.
And the point was, you can't have either Aaron or his two good sons remaining do this because they'd be contaminated. They'd just been consecrated, and you're going to contaminate the whole thing, and you've got to do things for Israel. So it's interesting that they had to call on relatives, but not priests, to carry them out and dispose of them. And, you know, boy, put yourself, I mean, these are stories we read, they're experiences that happen, but put yourself in the place of Aaron. You've just gone through 7 days of consecration of the priesthood. Your sons have participated in this. You're all ready to go. And now two of your sons are struck dead on the spot. And Moses says, you can't mourn for them because you're involved in a holy sacrifice here. They're still involved in the atonement that's in Leviticus 9. It carries into Leviticus 10. Boy, that's rough. Did Aaron ever do anything that he might reflect on later with respect to this punishment? That's an odd question. Awkward question. Did Aaron have any transgression in his past that he might have reflected on? What had happened? The rebellion? What happened in that rebellion? What did they do when Moses is up in the mountain and he came down, and what was going on?
Image.
Yeah, the golden calves. And, you know, it seemed, I mean, imagine, here's the person who's going to be the high priest of Israel, and he has been complicit with Israel in producing these golden calves. And, you know, I think when they brought those golden calves out, they actually said, this is representing, we're going to keep a feast to Jehovah. So the calf represented Jehovah. But, you know, the command was no graven image. I can't imagine that Aaron didn't later reflect and recognize, well, okay, I've suffered a lot here, but, you know, we did something that wasn't right. Anyway, it set the tone for sanctity from then on. That was a really dire situation. Did anybody in the New Testament ever find themselves struck dead like that? Who was that? Ananias and Sapphira. Now, I think we're all thankful that doesn't happen all the time. But, you know, it happened at the outset to kind of set the tone and let us know this is serious. And this we have to be really respectful. Say, Uzzah, thank you, Uzzah. Later on, with the not handling the Ark of the Covenant properly. Okay, there's other things here, but I think we're going to have to... Okay, notice in verses 16 to 20, they did not eat the sin offering that was offered in Leviticus chapter 9. They never ate it. And Moses is looking for the sin offering in verses 16 through 20. Remember, chapter 10 is part of chapter 9. The sin offering, they never ate it. And Moses is angry. So where is that sin offering? The priests are supposed to eat it. What did Aaron say on that occasion? Do you remember? Aaron had something. It wasn't being done right. They should have eaten that sin offering, but he didn't. And Aaron said in his defense, look what happened to me this day. Look at this disasters. Do you think I'm fit to eat that? Do you think God would have appreciated that? And Moses said, okay, I see your point. But what it brings to attention to me is this offering, this sin offering that should have been eaten, wasn't. Now, there's some kind of offerings that are never eaten, sin offerings that are never eaten. There's a certain kind of sin offering that isn't eaten. That is, any sin offering that's brought into the holy and used in the holy, you don't eat that, Leviticus 6, verse 30. And it turns out, if this Leviticus 9 was mostly about the church, it's interesting to me that it was not eaten by the priests. Now, that makes sense. If a sacrifice is for the church, then how can the church receive it? No, you burn that and you send it up to God and he accepts it. If it's for the world of mankind, then the church can receive that because they'll be God's representatives in glory and they'll receive those offerings. Now we're getting technical and we're going to stop. We're going to go to chapter 11. That's all we're going to say about chapter 10. What is in chapter 11? Well, you see up there, clean and unclean animals are described for us in chapter 11. That's the whole purpose of chapter 11. Now, I think you know what some of the rules were for animals, what's clean and what's unclean. What if for a four-footed beast, what is clean to eat and what is not? How do you determine? Rita? Cloven hoof and choose the cud. That's it. Okay, so can you... give Rita the microphone still, if you would. So would that include swine?
Because they don't chew the cud.
They don't chew the cud, but apparently they have a cloven hoof. Right. Okay, but that's why swine are not permitted. Okay, she says, take the mic away. Okay, all right. Now, then what you notice here, by the way, is up until verse 12, it's all about land animals. In verses 13 down through, verse 13. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. Up through verse 8 is land animals. Verses 9 through 12, what kind of animals does it describe there? Water animals. And what's the requirement? Two requirements for water animals. Fins and scales. That's it. So normal fish are okay. Eels, clams, they're not. By the way, a little story about that. In our class, Brother Herman Persaud used to live on an island in the, area? My mind went blank. But say again? Yeah, thank you. One of the Caribbean islands. And he used to eat clams all the time. And he says, you know, finally it got such a toxic level, he literally got sick. And from that time to this day, he cannot eat clams. Well, there's something in them that's not really quite right. And anyway, many of these things have health side effects. I'm not medical, you know. Talk to Tim later. He'll fill you in. But anyway, there's some things here that are practical. Now, starting with verse 13 and farther, what kind of animals are described? It's not land animals. It's not water animals. Birds. Now, I find it at least interesting to know that when you're talking about the unclean, you start with land, water, and then air. When you go to Revelation and you find, like in the trumpets or the seals or all these pictures that go through the age, you'll find it talking about the land was affected, and then he poured out upon the sea class, and then he poured out upon the air. That is the pattern that goes all the way through prophecy. Even the plagues, those that were on the earth suffered. That's the first plague in Revelation chapter 16. And the next one, he poured out his vial upon the sea, and every living thing in the sea died. And then after that comes the air. You'll find that's the sequence in which all of these prophecies are linked. I think there's some connection there. But let me ask you now the important question. Linking this to anything spiritual, where does the concern for what is clean and unclean ever come up again in the New Testament for spiritual things? Well, Sister Catherine, that's the first thing that comes to my mind. Who was it that received that vision of that sheet coming down?
Peter.
Mm-hmm. And what was the message? They said, kill and eat. What did Peter say to that?
I don't know. I can't remember.
Okay.
Something about not being unclean, that they shouldn't eat anything that's unclean.
So Peter says, look, I've never eaten unclean things. And what was the message from God to Peter in response to that? Because God said, kill and eat, Donna. That's okay. That's right. What I've called clean, don't you call unclean. Now, what's the meaning of this? What happened next in the book of Acts that this was even relevant? What was the... Cornelius, going to the Gentiles. We're all unclean. Sorry, folks. That's me too, you know. We're unclean here, but the Jews were clean. That's the concept. So if Leviticus 9 through 16 is taking you gradually from things that related to the gospel age and gradually getting to the kingdom age, I think this is part of that transition. Now, we started in chapter 10 with two spiritual classes that could be cut off from the priesthood and two others that will make it to the priesthood. That's all heavenly. That's spiritual. It doesn't have anything to do with the world of mankind. Now we get into chapter 11, clean and unclean. There's the introduction of the Gentiles into the heavenly call. Maybe that's why it's put here in this location, in this spot. Now you get a little bit farther. Let's look at verse 27, and I want to find one prescription in verse 27 that's also unclean about land animals. Now, Sister Ann, I see you have your Bible right there. Could you read that for us? Yes, please.
And whatsoever goeth upon his paws among all manner of beasts that go on all four, those are unclean unto you. Whoso toucheth their carcass shall be unclean until the eve.
Now give me an example of an animal, a big four-legged animal that goes on its paws. All of what I heard is right, and the first one I like the best. The bear. The reason I like that best as an example here is because in Revelation 13, papacy is described as the feet of a bear. Those are the paws. That's unclean. Spiritually speaking, you don't want to be part of that institution. That would be an unclean institution spiritually. And there is something here that remarkably is good that, frankly, I wouldn't be inclined to eat, but it says it's okay. And that's verse 22. Anne, you have your Bible right there. Would you read verse 22? This is some clean things that you can eat.
That's 11:22.
Yes, please.
Even these of them ye may eat, the locust after his kind, and the bold locust after his kind.
That's enough to give you the idea. You can eat a locust if you'd like to. Okay, now maybe you prefer not to. But they were clean. Now, did this ever come into play later in the New Testament? John the Baptist ate locusts, yeah. And apparently they're a clean animal. There's some directions there that explain why. But also in Revelation, when you get into prophecy, in the 9th chapter, you'll find a whole bunch of locusts coming out of a pit. And those locusts hurt only the bad people and none of the good people with the seal of God on their forehead. Those locusts, I would suggest interpretively, are Reformation doctrines that are helpful to the Lord's people. They're clean. Those locusts are clean, but they were not helpful to the other people in Christendom. Okay, we're going to go on to chapter 12. Chapter 12 is very brief, and it's about births. If a young lady gives birth, there's either two choices. It's going to be a young boy, or it's going to be a young girl in the birth. And then there has to be a certain process of being made whole after the birth. How many days is a woman recovering, as it were, in her experience, for a young male child? Say again? 33 is part of a good answer. Is it only 33? I say it's part of it because you're reading the scripture. It says 33. Okay. On the eighth day, you circumcise the child. But what preceded the 33, because the eighth is part of 33, 7 days. 7 days and then another 33. How many days total? 40. If it's a young girl, then how many days total do you have to deal with? Say 66 is like the 33. It's double that, but there's something in front of that. What'd you say? Did I hear it? 2 weeks. How many days is that? Add 14 in the 66. What is that? 80. So for a young boy, it's 40. For a young girl, it's 80 days of cleansing. Now, it tells you in the 12th chapter that when you're going to finally reach the end of these days, you're going to be cleansed. You have to bring the Lord an offering. And the offering is supposed to be, in verse 6, a burnt offering of the first year, and then a sin offering of a young bird. Or if you can't afford that, you just bring two young birds, one for a burnt offering, one for a sin offering. Do you ever have an example in Scripture of a young lady that gave birth that was poor and couldn't afford it, so she gave two birds? Brother Brad? That's Mary, the mother of Jesus. That's right. And it was 80 days in total. But she came and she had to offer two birds. Now, if you look at the account in Luke, the second chapter where this appears, and you compare that to Matthew, you find that Luke talks about the shepherds that visited Jesus the night of his birth, but he doesn't talk about the wise men. Matthew talks about the wise men. He doesn't talk about the shepherds. But it turns out the wise men came later than the shepherds. So the wise men had not yet came by the time that she had to go to the temple and offer these offerings. So she was still poor, and so she offered two birds. Now, I think if she had been after the wise men, she would have had some valuable gifts, and she could have offered the higher price. But I think that's kind of a little synchronous that tells you the sequence of events in Mary's life. Now, I would just suggest a point here about the births. When it comes to the births, the new classes that are developed in the divine plan, everything isn't clean. The birth process is messy, let's put it that way. And there's going to be some cleanup involved. Now, I think, I'm just going to suggest, because there are times going here, that this is talking about the development in the two ages of redemption. That's my suggestion. This is very interpretive, so check it out. Think about what you think this is credible. But I think there's, in the two ages of redemption, there are two classes involved. And those two classes are going to be the seed of promise, like Isaac, a man-child, and then by comparison. Because in Scripture, this is the rank. I mean, you can see it in the sacrifices. A male ranks a little bit higher than a female. Then the world of mankind is going to be developed, and that's going to be the birth of a female. Now, if you ever notice in Leviticus, the fourth chapter, about sin offerings, a priest is supposed to give a male for a sin offering. But just a common person, they're supposed to give a female for a sin offering. And I think that helps connect the genders. Males are talking about the gospel age. Females are talking about the millennial age. So in the gospel age, it's 7 and 33. And in the kingdom, it's 14 and 66. Can you apply that in any meaningful way? Well, I'll just give you a suggestion. Then we're going to go on. I think that 7 might apply to the 70th week of Daniel's prophecy that starts the gospel age. And the 33, from the time Jesus died until the 66 AD when the Roman army appeared on the horizon, 33 years. Okay, now you go to the kingdom, 14. We'll talk about this a little tomorrow. You'll see the number 14 introducing the kingdom repetitively. In Acts 27, there's 14 days of storm just before the kingdom breaks. And then 66, perhaps the world of mankind under sin and death that's going to be cleansed during the millennium. That was a very, very quick thought on the meaning of this, but we have to go on to chapter 13 and 14. Chapter 13 and 14 is about the cleansing of the leper. Now, I happen to know that Brother David and Sister Jean have studied this, so I'm going to ask Brother David, is this really leprosy that these chapters are talking about?
It's probably a stand-in phrase for a general type of contagious disease, just by the nature of where this is found in the cloth and in the house, so it's probably something other than leprosy.
Okay. It's not leprosy as we know it. It's a contagious disease. Okay. And amazingly, there's not really a cure involved here. Not really. There's an inspection to see whether it is something that's spreading or not. And if it's not spreading, you'll be clean. But if it's continuing to spread, it's going to be unclean. Now, Brother David mentioned that if you go through these two chapters, you're going to find different things that could be subject to this contagion. One of them is a person. Now, I would have thought anything dealing with leprosy was always a person. But it turns out that you can also have a contagion in your garment, in your clothing. And in chapter 14, under certain circumstances, you can even have a contagion in your house. Well, that's why some versions call the first case an infectious disease, and call the second case maybe something like mildew, and maybe the third case something like mold in your house, something like that. I think it's a picture of sin, but it's not true leprosy that we know about. Now, you can see this when you compare something like Leviticus 13. Oh, let's see, where is this? Leviticus 13, verse 13. Leviticus 13, 13. Who can read that for us? Now, when we're reading this, we want to say, is this really leprosy as we know it? That's the question. Who can read 13, 13 for us? Sister Connie, I think you had her hand up first. Connie, Zeus over here. When the end?
And if the disease has covered his whole body, he shall pronounce that the person clean. Since it has all turned white, he is clean.
Okay, I would never say that about leprosy. Okay, if you're white head to toe, then we'll say you're clean. Well, that sounds like you're really riddled with leprosy. But the point here, if you look at the descriptions, if it has turned white, it's healing and it's okay. That's the point. If it's actually turned dark, that's okay too. That's probably a scab. But if it's just an open sore and it's no better and it's spreading, you're in trouble. That's what they call leprosy. That's an infection. Something's spreading. So all of this, I think, is about the spread of sin. And our time is really... Where is the chairman? What time do we have? Tell me. It's not on the program. I think that means it's a two-hour study. Is that right?
It may well be.
Okay. Because we certainly don't have anybody here to resuscitate them. That's for sure. Okay, so let's just go on for just a few more minutes. And then this is the last area, the leprosy. And there's so many interesting things about this. Now, the fact that you can have this problem in your person or your garment or your house, I think says something about what the infection of sin can do to us. It can be in us, or it can be, when it talks about us, it can be your skin or in your head. It tells about that as a separate condition. And I think sin can be in our natural mortal bodies, the inheritance of Adam, or in our thoughts. If we're letting our thoughts go in the wrong direction, Tim said something about that today in his talk, that's leprosy. And if you don't heal that, you're not going to end up with life. That's the problem. And so that's why it differentiates the skull and the hair. And there's something to say about the hair and what color it turns in the definition of leprosy. Hair represents your fidelity to God. You remember Samson? Couldn't cut his hair. That's a sign of his fidelity. It was the Nazarite vow. If your hair becomes infected, you're in trouble. That's the lesson of the leprosy as well. If your devotion to God begins to corrupt. But it could be that you're not appreciating your covering, your redemption in Christ, your garment that is covering you from sin. If that begins to be infected, you're in trouble. And you've got to deal with infection in your garment. And by the way, oh, that gets too deep, but let me just pass on.
Those are the two things that Leviticus 13 and 14 is primarily about. But when you get towards the end of chapter 14, then it says there's one more problem that you have to worry about. And that's in chapter 14, 33 and 34. 33 and 34. But it's not the common problem. It's an exception. Who can read that for us? Joe, what do we have? Yes, Sister Sue, would you read that?
The Lord further spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, "When you enter the land of Canaan, which I give you for a possession, and I put a mark of leprosy on a house in the land of your possessions."
Okay, so that only applies when you come into the land of Canaan. In other words, leprosy in your house is not an issue while you're in the wilderness. Why not? What's that? That you didn't have a house, so it couldn't be an issue. But symbolically, I suggest that the wilderness condition represents our gospel age period of time. And when you come into the land, now you're talking about the millennial kingdom. So let's see what this house is all about. Let's look for a clue to this to 2 Corinthians chapter 5. 2 Corinthians 5, and hold on.
Garments or hair? Garments.
Yes. The garments could have mildew in them, that kind of leprosy. And if it was infected with leprosy, and you can't cure that, you're going to have to burn that garment. If you burn that garment, and if that garment represents your covering before God, you're without a covering, and therefore... Okay. Yeah. So now in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, does he say something about a house? Do you see something there about a house? Oh, verses 1 and 2. Let's read those two verses. 1 and 2. Joe?
"For we know that if our earthly house, this tent, should be dissolved, we are to have a building from God, a house not made with hands, everlasting in the heavens. For in this dwelling house we do indeed groan, earnestly desiring to put on the one for us from heaven."
Okay, so we want to be clothed with our house from heaven. Now, our present tabernacle is our old fleshly body. That's going to go. We know that's on the way out. Well, what we want to do is not be without. We want to have the house in heaven. So what I'm suggesting here is that the infection in the person or in the garment, that can be at any time. It can be for us who are consecrated to God in the present time. We can allow the sin to be spreading in us rather than contained and to be, restricted. It's scab over, so it's being cleansed. Then we can be pronounced clean if it's just a scab. But if it's spreading, we're going to be unclean. We'll lose our standing. Our garment, that can be corrupted too. And all of this can apply to the world of mankind and the kingdom as well. Because they can have sin that will spread in them in the kingdom. Or they can be not trusting in the righteousness of Christ that redeemed them. And they would be without covering while they still have sin in them. But there's one condition where leprosy is not a liability for us. And that is in the house. And that's because we don't have our house yet to be infected. Our house is something we're going to get when we go into the heavenly glory, and then we're going to have a house. So in the gospel age, your house is only future. So that's not an issue. In the kingdom, you can't lose your house with corruption because you're going to be immortal. You will have been tested. You will have been tried. You won't be in jeopardy. The church won't. Of having an infection of sin when you're in your house in glory. But the world will. The world will be here on earth in the kingdom, and they will be developing a new house, a perfect human environment. And that can be infected with sin during the millennium if they're not careful. And if it is, they're going to have to call in a priest. The church is going to have to intervene. They're going to have to check this out, and they're going to try to limit this. First of all, they take everything out of the house so that nothing else is contaminated. And then the priest is going to go in and find where this mold is. Let's call it that. And if you find that there, then you say, okay, let's quarantine this for 7 days and check it out at the end. And you come back again. It hasn't spread. Okay, maybe things are okay. But if it's spreading, we're in trouble. So he says, the next step, we're going to take and remove that plaster and scrape it all away and send it out to some unclean place. And we're going to wait another 7 days and just see if this contagion has not come back, we're in good shape. and the world can go on and they'll have their home and they'll live forever. But if it comes back, we're in bad shape. Now you got to tear down the house. You got to tear that, take the whole rubble. They've lost their hope for everlasting life. If that sin contagion is not contained, you're going to have a problem. Now, ultimately, in chapter 14 of Leviticus, what it says is, if you had leprosy or any of these problems, and then it's contained and you're called clean, it's not enough. You've got to now offer some sacrifices. You've got to offer the burnt offering to recognize your redemption in Christ. You've got to offer a sin offering to appreciate that the priesthood has cleansed you from sin. And so you've got to do offerings. You've got to be appreciative for the benefits we've required. You have to do that before you're really fully clean. So I think let's pause and summarize, and then we'll draw this to a close. In Leviticus 8, 9, and 16, we have the consecration of the priesthood. Then we have a preliminary atonement. You can't wait for the day of atonement. That's too far away. And I would suggest that chapter 9 has its focus on the atonement for the church. Chapter 16 has its focus on the atonement for the world of mankind. Between those are this series of the jeopardy that the spiritual classes are in. Two parts of the priesthood could be cut off. Those that lose their spiritual life and those of the great company who receive spiritual life, but they've lost the priesthood. And then two parts are going to be priesthood, I think Jews and Gentiles perhaps. Chapter 11, we have a concern now in the beginning of the gospel age for the clean and unclean. And the Gentiles, the unclean, are now going to be able to be clean and be inducted into the family of God. And then in chapter 12, I think, these two kinds of births represent the gospel age and the kingdom age, respectively, that are going to produce two different classes, one a little higher status than the other. And there's going to be problems. There's going to be problems incident to the development of the church. There's going to be some uncleanness during the gospel age. And so there's going to have to be some purging as a consequence. Likewise, there's going to be some uncleanness with respect to the rescue of mankind in the kingdom. So there's going to be some purging for this. And then chapter 13 and 14, three possibilities where leprosy can spread in your person, which includes your mind up here, or in your appreciation for the garment, what you've been justified from. If you consider that a common thing and you don't respect it, sin has entered in and you're going to have to burn that and you're not going to get life. And thirdly, but only in the kingdom, your everlasting abode, the earthly temple, the earthly reward for mankind could be infected with sin. Yours will not be, because it'll be up there and it'll be clean. And I hope yours will be up there and clean and like that. So I think that's the lesson. And we want to do away with sin. We don't want to succumb to leprosy. But if the priest sees that there's leprosy there, there's still a chance. Work on it. Let the priest inspect it.